Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Now, we've both been round the block a bit, haven't we?
Haven't we just?
And 50 years for you in the city?
I'm afraid so, and you're not much shorter than I am. 30 years as business editor at Sky News, and what a great job you did. And we've seen some highs and lows, and we've seen some
Certainly seen some booms and busts, haven't we? Our plan here, basically, is to interview, to chat to, I think, shall we call them the wise? Who've actually managed to navigate.
Or those who want to be wise.
Those who've navigated business and finance over the years.
I think this is a perfect way of actually introducing people to knowledgeable people who've had the experience and done well, achieved and delivered, rather than listen to the gossip in the street and also, you know, to the newspapers and television, which I'm not saying they're ill-informed, but they're not getting it right from the horse's mouth.
OK, well, I don't know about you, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Really excited by it.
Do come and join us. Welcome to this podcast on behalf of UK Investor Group. I'm Michael Wilson. I'm joined by a veteran of the city, David Buick. Welcome.
Greetings.
And so pleased that we've got Helen Thomas here. Helen Thomas founded Blonde Money. I want to say things like you're a polymath because you've walked the corridors of power. You're certainly a business commentator, certainly geopolitical commentator, political
economist.
There's a long list. But I think, if I may, maybe talk domestically and maybe talk about the local elections coming up. And what's your feeling about them? Why are they important this time round?
Yes, they are, for two reasons. The first, that the ruling UK Labour Party has made them so pivotal because, you know, in this quite long period of decline of support for the Labour Party and the approval rating of the Prime Minister, every lurch, every crisis, we keep on hearing, oh, but let's see what happens in the local elections. And, of course, Scotland and Wales elections too. So the Labour Party have themselves made it a target that we have to follow. But then the other part to this, the other reason it's significant, is it's going to be a litmus test of the public. You know, we can all sit here and be commentators, but at the end of the day, when the general public go in and put the X at the box, then we know what they're really thinking. And that will be a truly fascinating point.
Even local elections?
Yes, but I think local elections, because people want the opportunity to express how they're feeling nationally. That's not always the case in local elections, but I think it is this time round. But secondly, actually, those Scottish and Welsh elections are quite significant. They are the devolved assemblies for those nations, so they will have an impact on policy.
But it's fair to say, Helen, in a way that basically the electorate is so cheesed off with life.
Oh, yeah.
But I wouldn't be at all surprised if there was no more than about a 32% turnout.
Well, you're right on turnout. Yes, that'll be quite interesting. If it were higher than that, that would even be even more of a signal, wouldn't it, for people to be bothering?
I agree. But what I find interesting and fascinating is that the two main parties look like, and obviously we want your comments, they look like they're going to get trashed, and that the two new kids on the block, in the form of Reform and Green, look like they're going to do really well. Is this the end of the two-party system with the Liberal Democrats snapping at their heels at local elections? And I consider them on a national basis. Nobody's interested in what I think, but I think they're irrelevant.
Yes, it is. It's the end of the two-party system, but not quite the end of a two-block system. Because what seems to be going on is it's within the right-wing and the left-wing blocks.
Yep.
There's a rotation of votes. And you're right, the traditional, long-running Labour and Conservative parties are declining. People have had enough. And they're splintering and fracturing out to the extremes. We really shouldn't be too surprised by this. It started post-2008. This is a kind of a long tale of crisis after crisis, of wanting change, of believing the establishment doesn't work for the man on the street. And until a party comes along and addresses that, tries to make it work for the man on the street, they'll keep registering their discontent.
Do you think that, I mean, I can sort of understand why the Greens appeal to younger people. I would be really cross if I couldn't get a house and a student debt
or whatever it may be.
You can understand that, can't you?
Yeah.
I mean, and yet it's all right having that kind of popularity. Can they stay the course?
the Green Party. Well, it's quite dramatic, the rise of the Greens. And politics is so often about momentum, and sort of Reform had the first shot at that after the general election 2024. The Reform Party were nowhere that year, 1 to 2% in the polls, then regularly topping polls. The Greens are now have sort of got the next breath of fresh air that's coming in. I went to an event where I was hearing from a polling company, and they'd done a focus group about the Greens. And even amongst older voters, refreshing was the word. Refreshing, a true liberal progressive party is what they said.
Well, the word madness didn't come in at all.
Well, here's the thing.
Sorry,
of course, the more exposure that the Green Party get, as any party gets, and newer parties have, it'll be, can it pass muster in the real cold, harsh light of people asking them for their sensible economic plans? But look, it's polling shows, if you ask people, do you want to tax the wealthy and the billionaires? Do you want to make big companies pay more in taxes? People want that. That's a majority of people of all parties support those policies, and they are called Green Party policies. Now, us here in this room, we have all worked in the worlds of finance, we'll have and economics, we'll know there are reasons that won't work, but it is no doubt a popular policy.
There doesn't seem to be any doubt about it. I want to turn this conversation a little bit towards the city now, because what concerns me, whether what we read in the newspapers or what we don't read in the newspapers, is Starmer going to stay until these election results? Who's on manoeuvres, you know, the rest of it? The gilt market sits out at me like a flashing light. Because we've seen 10-year gilts last week at some time, Helen, though they're a little easier now. I haven't seen the papers this morning. 5% makes me wobble. And it won't take a lot before people, if they don't like what they're seeing underneath, the fact is you cannot carry on spending and spending and spending and hope that the gilt market will take it on the end of the chin. How do you read it?
Well, we are at a really pivotal moment for the gilt market because of fixed income markets more broadly. So away from what we're just talking about here now about the specific issues in the UK, we obviously have a huge global economic shock from the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. I'm sure we'll get on to talking about that. Yeah. But that means a big inflationary shock coming down the pipe. Can't be avoided, which all else equal means higher interest rates everywhere. The world is awash in debt incurred since the pandemic. So to digest all of that debt, investors will demand a higher yield, as we have seen. And we've seen this repricing. We're seeing central banks globally flip from talking about rate cuts to rate hikes. So we just had Australia hiking interest rates. So all of that means that the gilt market's sort of already on notice. But where you're right to flag that sort of flashing red light for gilts is that every time we have a sell-off, they sell off more.
Yeah.
If we have a rally, they actually rally more. We call it a high beta. You know, they have a greater sensitivity to the moves. And it is because of partly the UK hugely uniquely exposed to this energy shock because of our high energy prices and our inflationary economy. But also the political risk premium that has been built in. Because, as we've said, the electorate are fragmented, no one can get policy through, it's hard, it's a weak government, you know, this loveless Labour landslide was how it was described, and my goodness, how that has come to pass.
Turned to pass, isn't it?
This is also the moron factor as well, isn't there, which is built in. I like that phrase, actually.
I could have just said that, couldn't I?
Yeah. But it, I mean, that's quite important, isn't it?
It is.
It's terribly important.
I don't get the feeling, I mean, I may be wrong, and this is not a political comment by any stretch of the imagination, I don't think that many people actually really understand what's going on.
Oh, I think absolutely you're spot on with that. Because, you know, economics sounds dull and boring and gilt markets, what's it all about? But actually the British people are starting to really learn what it's all about, as we saw in the wake of the...
Well, their cost of living, they're feeling it, the pinch.
Oh, absolutely. But what's gone wrong is how you solve that. What are the answers? How does it work? And this point that, you know, £100 billion a year is spent simply on servicing the debt. Meaning there's no money for anything else. And that's before... even higher interest rates, because this is the problem. It's not static. It's it, it it's it's debt upon debt. I mean, I think people actually know that from their own lives, don't they? When they go on credit cards.
Yeah. Can I just simplify something that Michael and I were discussing before, which is this business of what I call good debt and bad debt.
Right.
I mean, the good debt we all know is new hospitals, roads, infrastructure, stuff that we can know creates growth. And bad debt is borrowing money to pay off doctors, railway workers, whatever it may be, teachers, however laudable their claims may be. Whilst we've got this welfare system that is utterly bloated, we can't afford any more bad borrowing.
Well, this is why it had all been about growth. You know, the point, you need to have productive growth. You can borrow to finance productive growth from some of the things that you're talking about. But there are so many other claims on the money that the state is spending. So I think, you know, back to Michael's point about kind of, do people really understand the gravity of what is required? There's a nasty dose of medicine that needs to be taken to resolve this. And if politicians won't do it willingly, I'm afraid the markets will impose it upon them.
Would you mind if I just brought Helen back to reform?
Be my guest, yeah.
This is something that you've noticed as well. We should address reform somewhere or the other. Must talk about it. I get the feeling it's not so much a political party as a business. But I may be completely wrong. But it does seem as though there's a considerable lack of transparency about some of the financing there. Do we care?
So, I mean, Reform initially was constituted as a company, I believe. The actual party
was
founded as a limited company, I think, with shareholders, and mostly it was all to do with Farage, and Tice had some of it, etc. Richard Tice. And of course, many of the people intimately involved in the party from a business background. So, you know, we'd be looking at it that way. But you can't get around the rules. There are quite strong rules here in the UK about how you constitute yourself as a valid party and how you operate. But what appears to have happened, what's a bit of a trickier ground, is that, specifically Nigel Farage has received a personal donation. Prior to becoming an MP, received a large personal donation from a person.
£5 million.
£5 million from a person who has also gone on to donate to Reform UK, the political party. And, you know, it looks, I guess, you know, we just, perhaps we've been naive in this country. We've not been used to perhaps some of the big money that sloshes around that you see in many other countries, very much so in America, of course, where they have much looser campaign financing. Well, they have very little campaign financing rules. It's all about
money.
Billions, literally. Whereas here, there are rules about how many leaflets you can print and you know, what name goes on them and all of these things. But it looks like our disclosure rules have to catch up with the world that we live in.
What was interesting, there was a very good article published by Fraser Nelson, which caught my imagination. It wasn't so much about the lack of transparency over Nigel Farage's gift. It was much more of the fact is, does the electorate care? Because we had this business with the SNP, with Alex Salmon, who I'm afraid was not whiter than the driven snow. And then we, of course, had Nicola Sturgeon's husband, who looks like he's in a spot of bother financially, dismissed by SNP and by others, because it looks like SNP are going to romp on Thursday again. So my point to you is, does it really matter? I mean, it should, but does it?
I think it contributes to the ongoing decline in trust in our institutions and in our politics. And that is only going to be a negative thing. I think that perhaps a more cynical generation is springing up thinking, this is what they all do, don't they? Why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't I? Maybe I would. Maybe they see a TikTok influencer and they think, oh, yeah, that's how it goes. You get into power and then you run a side hustle on some business venture.
But Christopher Harbord's crypto bit, that's what I don't understand. Yeah. Apparently Nigel was alleged to say that he's going to encourage the Bank of England to realter their ideas in regard to perhaps including crypto, in their general financial manifesto. I mean, I don't know if it's true, but this crypto thing is cropping up. And there's still, as far as I'm concerned, a bit of a cumulonimbus cloud over it because we don't know enough about it.
Well, of course, yes. I mean, the entire crypto industry is rather opaque broadly, but it's coming out into the light. I think that we can't stop a politician choosing a course of action on a policy that they genuinely think is the right one and may well indeed be the right one for the country, like looser crypto regulations or anything else. Mm. But with any conflict of interest, it's got to be declared, and then the public can decide. If they think they don't like you, you're too much of a grifter, they'll vote with their feet. But I think you're right to bring it up in terms of we will see more of it across the board.
I'm confident we will.
You're seeing it in every country in terms of this. But look, for all good politicians and all good business people, it's in all their interest to try and keep these things as transparent as possible.
Could we move our attention away from local
these
politics?
Shores? I think we should.
To equities, just slightly, because this is. How investors are actually going to look at this. Is the advice stay out?
What do you mean, in the UK or indeed any
UK to start with? Yes.
Well, I think equities must be kept separate from what's happening in the bond markets. We're in a bit of a strange parallel universe between the two, where there's quite a lot of rising tide lifts all boats on equities globally that is helping in the UK. And of course, FTSE 100 companies are hugely international. They're not a bellwether really for the UK, as you've talked about many times, both of you. And then the bond market, which as we've talked about, has all these vulnerabilities. I think it's just, it pays to do your homework. Either be fully on board with an index and hold, buy and hold and try and ride the ups and the downs and plan very much for the long term. Or if you are a bit more short-term and you need to be a bit more careful about the money that's you've got invested, then you're going to need to differentiate. And I think you're going to have to take as a given that we will have a fragmented politics. We may very well be having a slow-motion fiscal crisis. And therefore, that will impact, it's going to impact the consumer. Yields are going up. Recession, dare I say, should be on everyone's outlook. Not saying it will, but it's out there. So therefore, that's therefore probably you want to be defensively positioned when it comes to UK exposed assets.
I mean, all these things that we have to watch, and you only have to look at the list of stocks and shares that come out every day, is that retail looks vulnerable outside of the supermarkets, and you have to be very careful of entertainment as well, because people, if they have to pull their horns in, will do so.
Time to be boring, do you think?
Well, yeah, I agree. Yeah. But generally, and this is something we have to discuss with Helen, is AI. I mean, whatever we think of Trump, and whatever we think that he's, like Geppetto with Pinocchio pulling the strings where it suits him from time to time, there is a massive appetite out there, almost too great for AI, when you think of some of the figures that have been put out by Alphabet, Apple, Microsoft and others during the course of the last week, where, let's face it, Helen, on the whole, the results coming out of the United States for this last quarter, when everybody's been talking sackcloth and ashes, have been pretty good.
Absolutely, yes, they have been. I mean, it's a behemoth and a juggernaut for a reason, isn't it, the tech sector in the US? And we are no doubt in the midst of a technological revolution. The tricky part now, I think, for AI is the constraints. So there's the supply constraints on semiconductors, which there's been continued warning on that even absent before the Middle Eastern situation, that there was so much demand that they just couldn't produce the chips quick enough to satisfy it. Now you've got issues like helium transits through the Strait of Hormuz, and helium is used to cool down semiconductors in fabrication. So that's an added constraint onto it. So at some stage, this juggernaut will just simply be held back by almost being too successful, really. Yeah. But that doesn't mean long-term this isn't still a good investment, because AI is going nowhere.
When you say that, it's here to stay is what you mean.
Yes, exactly. It's here to stay. It's part of the landscape. And it's not really dot-com boom turning to bust.
No.
This is real world, real life impact that is happening. So I think that, the US... that's why I slightly asked you, Michael, when we looked at equities, UK versus US, because the growth story on the US side is they are both protected from and indeed benefit from some of the energy crunch by being exporters now of oil, net exporters of oil, very different to back in the day. So they are building and investing in their own grid building data centres, connecting them into the grid. And then you've got the AI and the tech itself. So sort of the US is actually quite protected from some of these things and may well benefit.
Yeah, I think you have to be light on your feet, because what I found interesting, somebody who's not a nerd but pretty close to it, is that if you looked at the FTSE, the DAX and the CAC and other European indices for January, February and March, they were much more interesting, and including Japan, than the United States were, which was in a little bit of a doldrum.
Yes.
That's why I talk about Geppetto and, you know, Donald Trump and, you know, pulling the old puppet, is that there's no question, in my opinion, that to ignore the United States of America, even though they seem to have dug us a very serious hole in the Gulf of Hormuz, we ignore the United States, I think, at its peril. But, Helen, could you talk a little bit about Hormuz, oil, what you actually think? And do you actually think that Trump has dug a hole and he's desperate to get out of it? And how does he get out of it?
Yes, I do. And I think that where we are right now, as we talk at the beginning of May, a lot of the damage has been done and is baked in, and hence this huge stagflationary shock is permeating through the global economy. And let me give people a scale of this. Two ways to think about this. One is to remember the Ever Given ship that got stuck in March 2021, 5 years ago. There's quite a lot of excitement at the time and quite a lot of memes and jokes. We were all locked down and people were worried they weren't going to get their parcels, their Amazon packages, because this container ship had got stuck in the Suez Canal. It was only for 6 days. Behind it were about 450 ships. It took a couple of weeks to clear them and then a couple of months to get back to normal. And that was one ship in one waterway for 6 days.
That's the supply chain as well, isn't it?
We now have equivalent of 800 Ever Givens stuck in the Persian Gulf, and it's been 6 weeks and counting. Yeah. So, and then to wrap your head around what that means, because it is tricky to really get to imagine what that means. I saw an estimate that Wood Mackenzie, I think, did this analysis where the amount of oil production that has not happened due to this closure is equivalent to all vehicles in the world globally not driving for 11 days. It's huge. It's huge. And that's obviously just the oil element of this, right? I mentioned helium. There's the urea and ammonia for fertilizers and sulfur and all these other things. And that knock-on fertilizer impact is going to impact the fields, the crops right now. It's not getting delivered. Let alone the knock-on point of if the ship does turn up, let's say it takes another 2 months to get there, well, it's probably a bit too late to get on the field. But first of all, are you going to get it off the ship into the lorries if people can't turn up for work because they can't
or
get
the
petrol and diesel?
Yeah.
The refineries, it's the wrong kind of fuel for this, that and the other. The whole thing, this is, I mean, it's mind-boggling. Literally, we could probably do 10 more podcasts just on this alone. Maybe we will, if people are interested. But that's why I want to say that Trump is significant, of course, and the US and Iran trying to find a way through, and they'll eventually find some way for Trump to climb back down. But the damage has been done.
But you could see this being protracted for another couple of months, maybe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this shock as well to the supply chain is going to be at least 12 months, at least, if not more.
I think this has been a fantastic podcast for everybody if they listen to this, because this has really focused what danger we have. You get stuff on the news, the television, the thing, but they say it's serious, but you've painted this picture which is disturbing to say the least.
I know, I've been talking to lots of people about this, and you guys know me a long time. I'm quite a cheery, optimistic person.
Yeah,
I don't like to have to talk about this, and I'm not being alarmist, I'm trying to be realistic. You know, my business looks at what is going to happen, not what I'd like to happen. But it is at odds with what's happening in the S&P 500. If I might say just one thing about equities, which I think the Liberation Day move last April, so in the wake of Trump imposing the tariffs, but then saying, I'm going to pause, we got that huge reversal, a quite painful one, because a lot of people have gone short. And if you look at the SPY, that's the ETF that tracks the S&P 500, it tracks it very, very closely. It's deeply liquid. But on that day of the reversal, it printed at a premium of 90 basis points. Normally trades within under one basis point. You guys know this. We've been in markets a long time. Scramble to cover the short. Gets bid up. Causes chaos. But what it has done is created what I like to call don't get caught short So that's the market now. And so even though there are plenty of reasons to be short, for many of the reasons we've discussed, there's a fear of, oh, if Trump does something, I'll get caught short. I can't possibly do that. So they rush back into being invested.
I think we've been slightly underpinned by the help that the market in terms of earnings has been quite good.
Well, that, to be fair, there is also that. And as we've said, there's the tech piece of this that's chungling along. Defence investments obviously booming and going to keep going. I saw Palantir's results had their biggest quarterly jump in sales since they went public. So, you know,
got rubbished at the beginning of the year as well, their shares. I mean, just, you're absolutely right. Well, mm-hmm. Can I ask one question, Michael? Mm-hmm. I think it's very... We're here to, initially, though I found this whole podcast fascinating. Come on, neck on the block. How many seats do Labour lose? How many seats do the Tories lose? Is Reform and Green nailed on to be the big parties?
Yes, Reform should take about 1,500 seats. The Greens maybe 500 or more. The Conservatives, I'm sorry to say, are irrelevant, really. Kemi's doing a much better job, but she's outpacing the trashed brand of her party. The key will be the Labour Party, and I think we're looking at a two-handle, I think 2,000 seats lost, because people want to send a signal. Even Labour voters want to send their party a signal. Now, that would be pretty disastrous. We are told that around 1,500-ish is, you know, the loss that's expected for the Labour Party. But the key thing here is, and I've done this myself, I've pounded the streets and delivered leaflets over the years. You don't really believe it until the results come in. You daren't believe it. No. So in their mind, they'll be thinking, oh, maybe if we scrape to just maybe 1,000 or under, we'll be okay. So I'm sorry to say that, you know, actually more than 1,000 is going to really upset Labour activists, MPs and supporters, and thus trigger yet another wave of calls for Starmer to go.
Final question, and I think it's absolutely important. Will Nigel need Kemi to go into coalition 6 months before the next general election?
Will he need her? I'm not sure he'll need her, but I think he might. They may well be a pact between the Conservatives and Reform. The reason he might not need her is in a 4-5-party system, let's say four parties, you only need 25% of the vote plus one.
Got it.
You've won all the seats. But I think you can see that both are realising there may be something they need to do to help one another out down the track.
Always a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. It's been...
Talk all day. Wonderful. Thank you.
Helen Thomas, thank you very much indeed. We'll see you soon.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.